Blog Talk Radio.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Very well. I wanted to give
I wanted George to give a little introduction to your to you, and you know, and your new book. Now I'm excited to see it. But I'm excited to read this one. So what's this one do? What does it do? It's a sequel to the last one, I'm assuming, right?
Yes, and it picks up what I always considered to be the major or the only flaw in the first book, which was it did not explore or really comment too much about the mysterious character, Dr. Zhen. Dr. Zhen in the first book is the mentor. He's the one who sets up the paranormal department of Romania's intelligence department,
right.
Zero, they call it.
So
he set it up.
Did you ever get a chance to meet the guy who wrote the book, or not wrote the book, gave you the information earlier on the first book?
Well, he is the guy who wrote the book. But no, I haven't. I do correspond with him frequently, but I haven't got to meet him in person yet.
Oh.
He almost came to my house, but he said that he decided not to because he said it would have given me a lot of problems that I didn't meet.
So
because
he's
very closely surveilled when he's around, wherever he goes, by the secret departments.
So,
Leo, if I may, Peter, you have a hell of a story to tell in the second book, or to continue in the second book. You know, because of the time factor, why don't we leave it up to you and give us an idea where we're going now with the moonrise compared with the sunrise that you took us on the first trip. And,
right.
You know, if there's anything you'd like to say about it, please let this be a mouthpiece to introduce this new book, because I personally really think that this has a lot to say of the times that we're in and the paradigm shift that we're experiencing. And, Peter, you know, knowing each other and going back with the understanding of the Philadelphia experiment and going through time with David Anderson and so forth, I think this falls right into the lap of this this fractal consciousness that we're experiencing. You know, it's funny that what's been going on lately with Obama and so forth, but it's part of this illusion that's been lifted. And, you know, people are seeing for what it is. And now it's a matter of seeing for what it is and changing not only it, but also ourselves. But, you know, let's not get carried away. I don't want to. But I'd like you to continue, if you can, and give us an idea of where we're going with Radu.
Okay.
Before you continue, I just want to put your mind to rest. We extended the show tonight to a 90-minute program, so we got a little more time to discuss this. So go ahead, Pete. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, the first book ended with the discovery in the Bucegi Mountains of Romania, underneath the Romanian Sphinx, a secret chamber with holographic technology that read out the history of the Earth, would, you know, show up your DNA in microscopic format if you put your hand over a table, and could also read out the DNA of alien species if you put your hand on another part of the table, could also read out a mixture, a hybridization of our DNA, your DNA, whatever, with the other species of another world, because they would see the star system over that species from which it allegedly came. Now,
I just wanted to break in for 1 minute just to explain to the listeners who aren't familiar with your work that in the Transylvania Sunrise you talk about the Sphinx, okay, the Sphinx that I believe is 25,000 years old or so.
Oh, 50,000 years old, they believe.
Yeah, and that beneath this Sphinx that was discovered in Transylvania, that this is where you found these vaults or these archives,
holographic archives.
Yeah, but it was in the it was like a series of not caves but rooms.
The chamber.
What's that?
it's a chamber. It's not a series of caves. It's a chamber, a tunnel.
Right, and in that these tunnels went, I believe one went to Iraq. Is that correct?
Okay, you're confusing it a little bit. Let me. I was getting to that. The chamber has, and first off, I was not there. This is
from the author, right?
Right, and in the chamber is a table that reads out the DNA stuff I was showing. Another section reads out the history of the Earth. And then, in addition to this, there are three tunnels, and one tunnel goes to the Giza Plateau and has a similar chamber that's not identical. There's another tunnel that goes to Tibet via the Baghdad area and has another extension going off to Mongolia, and that one goes to Tibet.
How much? I can't imagine what's the distance of these tunnels?
Well, it's the distance is pretty much whatever the distance it would be from Romania to Egypt, and Romania.
It has to be tremendous.
Thousands and thousands of miles, and it's also with some sort of high tech equipment, because what they're discovering here is that the ancient man knew more than the present man, and knows more than the future man, at least for the immediate future. So this is antediluvian technology that surpasses our wildest horizons. But there was also a third tunnel there I didn't get to mention. A third tunnel that goes, it's the most mysterious of all. It goes into the inner Earth, and we do not know exactly where it goes, although it's alluded to. But that's basically, the first book brings us into the circumstances of how this was discovered, the political infighting around it, which is fascinating, and the corroboration of the story, which is that after all this happens, Americans move in with the technology. They're the ones that enable the technology to bore through these mountains and discover this tunnel with their satellite technology, is how it was first discovered. But there is an unprecedented collaboration of American and Romanian troops and diplomacy ever since that, with Romania coming into NATO. So this is part of the corroboration. There's also in the new book a series of newspaper clips from Romania which describe Romanian journalists commenting on it and giving their corroboration of bits and pieces of the story. But we can't prove.
Is he the name of the guy?
Dr. Zien. X-I-E-N.
Okay. This guy... you're releasing this book, if he's under such surveillance and this is all secret, your releasing of this book must be, it must have been somewhat, not authorized, but at least there was nobody preventing you from publishing his work.
It was time for it to be written. It was meant to be happening right now.
There has been, these books were published in Romania many years ago. It's taken me a long time to get the translation done and to get the agreement. My email sat in a spam folder for a year, and he apologized for it, but I wasn't able to consolidate the agreement till I was in Romania last year, and then it was all fine. And there's a lot of...
You still haven't met him, right? You just worked.
No, I have not. I have not met him, and yeah. I've met with his publisher. His publisher has not met him.
Wow,
but
fascinating.
Yes.
Keep going, Peter. I'm drooling right now as you're talking because it's so exciting. I think for this information to come out, but it connects with so many different things, which has been part of. This knowledge that we've been after for years.
Well, yes, and to tell you that there is a certain amount of tension on the author to not publish more stuff. He was allowed to publish. He's also had a certain amount of protection around him from the main character in the book, Cesar Brad, and Cesar is the one that Dr. Zen mentored to become the head of Department Zero, and Cesar is a character with very strong paranormal ability and a good sense of ethics, and he was mentored by this mysterious Dr. Zen, and as they say, Cesar appears in the book, and he's the one that sets it all up for Radu to write the book, and he's very highly placed in the Romanian government, so he can protect Radu, but then, as of recent times, he left. He left to become, to this very nebulous term or title, which Radu said he went to become an ambassador to the beings in the inner earth. Now, we're not told who those beings are. I can imagine something of what they might be. They're not extraterrestrials, they're interterrestrials. So this is what he went to do. And since he left, there has been a lot of tension, and he can't write any more books. He cannot write any more books, but Cesar has predicted a time and recently corresponded with him, which caused a lot of political...
So you believe there's a power play going on now?
There very definitely is, and he said that so much of it surrounds the Egyptian controversy we just went through with the riots in Egypt.
Yes.
And it's very important to comment, because we can't prove this, but we can corroborate certain aspects, and we can look for insightful windows of opportunity, one of which was Facebook. Facebook was about to be purchased. There was a big Goldman Sachs offering in January before the Egyptian riots. And you've got to remember that Facebook is what caused this riot to take place. And Facebook, the whole history of the guy who started Facebook is interesting if you go into it. But I don't want to digress. But anyway, Facebook was about to be offered by Goldman Sachs, supposedly, now this is where the rumor sets into, an Arab billionaire, maybe even the king, I don't remember, but who wanted to stop by Facebook to stop this, you know, overthrow of the, you know, the leaders in the Arab worlds, because it was a big threat to them. And of course, the guy who started Facebook is Jewish. Now, I don't know what he's tied into being Jewish. It doesn't mean he's part of a Zionist conspiracy.
Zuckerman, you mean?
Zuckerman, yeah. But I mean, so he's a very intriguing character from an MK Ultra profile.
Right. Oh, really?
His mom is a shrink.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah,
he's an MK Ultra profile, you think?
Well, and right up in your neck of the woods, I believe, in Westchester. But yeah, I mean, it you know, just because his mother's a shrink doesn't mean he was a part of MK Ultra, but it's a or whatever the modern term is, but it's what you call a major flag, because, you know, shrinks. There's a lot that's not known about shrinks, that they have their own little cult.
That's true. What about was it Yale that he went to, or I forget?
Harvard.
Let's not lose track of this.
Well, no, it was important, because a lot of recruits are from the Ivy League, and I believe Tim Leary was from Harvard.
That's correct. He was a professor at Harvard.
Yeah, he was. And he started his mind control stuff and his, then. But I was curious, Zuckerman has serious ties to the NSA and so on. In fact, Facebook, I think, was sponsored by, that's where he got the money for the startup.
Okay, and what's interesting about this this Egyptian angle that I was saying to the riots in Egypt is that right before Mubarak stepped down, he appointed Zahi Hawass as the, you know, third in line.
Yeah, he was a Secret Service guy. He was he was known for being a Gestapo type of guy.
Zahi Hawass, I've never known him for that. He was the curator of the Giza Plateau. From Cornell, or from the University of Pennsylvania, where he went to school.
Well, the guy that Mubarak wanted in there, okay, and so did the United States, was he was the head of the secret police.
No. This is a different story. This is Zahi Hawass, the museum, the guy who's
chair for Egypt.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with intelligence.
No.
This has to do with Zahi Hawass, who is the curator of Egyptian artifacts.
This
is like putting the head of the Smithsonian in the United States to be next in line behind the vice president to be president.
Right.
And it doesn't make any sense. But what I'm pointing out to you is that these, as the curator of the Egyptian artifacts, he would also be the curator of anything below the ground in Giza where the Romanians and Americans were going to, you see? It becomes an issue. He's now the territorial possessor of that because he is the curator of artifacts. Now, this is an artifact. Now, what I've found out since, and I can't prove this to you, but it comes through a personal association of somebody who's been involved with this stuff going way back into Egypt, who was personally threatened over it. But Zahi Hawass had knowledge of so much antediluvian extraterrestrial artifacts, if you will, that have been buried. He would never admit to anything going back to Atlantis. And one of the reasons for this, he was being paid, allegedly, being paid off, and he would not do this. Now, he is now being threatened with jail time.
Wow,
He's between a rock and a hard place now. And the whole distraction of, according to what I was told, the CIA went in and got those artifacts to remove them. Now, these artifacts would only point to the bigger chamber underneath. And again, this is not provable. It's backstory, but it's from a source that I know who was involved with certain expeditions that just haven't been talked about other than in my newsletters. And Zahi Hawass is now being threatened with jail time, and one of the most intriguing things is he could turn around and talk about this. If he's put in jail, he could squeal on all the things he's been hiding. Apparently these artifacts have been taken that he was harboring for all these years. So there's a lot of cover story, and this is only a tangent of the main story we're trying to get to.
But before he squeals, I would think he'd be taken care of before then.
One would assume so.
Yeah, but
you're dealing with destiny here too, my friends. You know, things are being released, you know, for a purpose at a certain time. There is some synchronicity being played out. So, you know, this is just not a stab in the dark.
Let me just finish my thought. What my concern is, you're talking about the archives, and you're talking about Egypt, and you're talking about whatnot. But have they? Is he in charge? Was he the individual that banned anybody from looking into the Sphinx? The Egyptian Sphinx, because Casey supposedly said that under the paw was of the Sphinx was this library, which held all the, and that would soon be revealed, I guess, or something. That was the prediction. But is that what they're going after or what?
Well, yes and no. That was a thing they were trying to do, that Charlton Heston did this documentary, which was a spinoff and a whole obfuscation of what really was going on there, what should have been going on. My friend was part of an expedition that went underneath the Sphinx and actually found chambers below the Sphinx, and they did it without authorization, and they took some footage. A cinematographer, Boris Saeed, who's now passed away, took the footage. It was actually offered for sale on the Art Bell Show many years ago, and so some people have that footage. Boris passed away. The estate's kind of, you know, in a question mark, and I don't know I don't even know if the people in the estate know where the film is. But this was film that actually showed that some of the stuff that the Egyptologists those in charge were not telling the truth. Now, we really don't know of the secrets beneath the paws, because they were supposedly removed a long time ago, after the war, again by the CIA type people. Now, Edgar Casey also said there were about four other sphinxes, but that they were no longer there. And I would only attribute to his, that Romanian Sphinx was one that he didn't, it was there and he didn't realize it, or he, his prediction was part of those percentages that were not correct. But he
could be both too, so who's
yeah.
to say?
Yeah, but the Sphinx, this is a more complete record. You know, we're expecting in our mindsets to have little, you know, papyrus scrolls or tablets. Well, these we're talking about holographic stuff. It's much more complete and comprehensive than anything we might have imagined.
Have
but
they,
these, go ahead.
Your new book. Have they discovered at all, or any inference or any understanding of who these people were these aliens were, or who these people were that had this incredible knowledge?
We get a little bit of insight in this book. This is the second book of a series, and I haven't read the third and the fourth, but
right.
the which I'm trying to get translated as we speak. The second book is very important, and as George was alluding to, synchronicity times, because it starts off with, again, a corroboration by the journalist that I told you about, and then it goes into the Radu Sinemar being, you're still with me, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought I heard something. All right, so Radu is being approached by a man in Romania who says that a Tibetan Lama wants to meet him. And so there's this whole setup for him to meet this Lama. And the whole arrangement is very tenuous because he doesn't normally meet people. So basically, to make a long involved story short, the Lama turns out to be a man. And he's really a Tibetan Lama who escaped Tibet in 1956 before the Chinese invaded, and he ends up working in the employ of the Chinese government as somebody who's the head of parapsychological departments, because he's expert in that. He's very evolved and has many gifted abilities that would far surpass anything the Dalai Lama might have, but then again, he's not, you know, he's in the court of the Dalai Lama, but he's bigger and beyond that.
Now, in this book, what can we expect to read? I apologize. George told me about it a short today, and I haven't really had a chance to look at it. I believe it's an e-book right now.
It is available in e-book right now on Amazon Kindle. If you have a Kindle, it can be downloaded tonight. The other book was supposed to get in here today. There was a problem. It's going to be here tomorrow. And if they screw that up, it'll be Monday at the latest. But anyway, it's right here. So the what happens, this whole meeting with the Lama is arranged by a very unique and mysterious man who uses the pseudonym of Eleanor. And Eleanor is somebody who's an alchemist, who comes from a long line of alchemists. He was contacted by his ancestor at about the age of 19 and initiated into a tradition. This ancestor had been living for hundreds of years, since about the 1400s, and had been watching his genetic line to find an appropriate person to initiate. And this initiation, now this is going to throw a lot of people, because, you know, of course you can't live hundreds of years. You can't live hundreds and hundreds of years. Well, human beings as we know them in this society basically live, you know, 75, 80 years, and that's considered a decent amount of life. Anything beyond 80 is, you know, you're on the house's money, and if you're doing good especially. And I know this to be suspect just from my own personal initiation into practice of Qigong, and that people do not know how to breathe, they do not use their full lung capacity, therefore they die of organ failure. Natural causes is organ failure. If each one of the lobes of your lungs feeds different internal organs. So if you're breathing, most average person is breathing with 5% of their lung capacity. With a little bit of exercise and a little bit of a proper training, you can start filling the lobes of your lung, and you'll start feeding your internal organs, and you'll start euthanizing. And this is demonstrable, but most people are too, you know. So I've been initiated into this particular practice of Taoist Qigong in the last, you know, 5 years of my life. So now it's getting up to the point where this is another tradition that is saying you can live hundreds and hundreds of years. Instead of like what I'm looking at is 150, 200 years maybe in my perspective, but this is saying we can up the whole aspect. And this is a tradition that is taken very seriously, and of course the author is being introduced to this and he doesn't know what to believe because he's saying, well, this guy looks like he's 30, but his driver's license says that he's 60. Huh. He says, why would he fake a driver's license?
Well, and then I, for one, plan to live forever.
Well, we're talking about in a human body.
I understand.
You will live forever, but we're talking about in the human body, which nobody's going to live in their human body forever. So these are having extended life extension, and they're saying it with a straight face, and they're talking about a tradition. But where this becomes very important, as George was alluding to earlier in the show, is that this is now taking the focus off of the external, like the Philadelphia Experiment and the Montauk Projects are external incidents that affect people and almost invariably in not a very good way. It's like it's an external event, and it transforms the way society interacts in the secret sector and all this stuff. But most of the people who were involved in the Montauk Project, you know, are very much into the victimization of what happened to them and the continuing of that victimization. This is not a healthy thing.
And I was just reading the description of the book here on Amazon, and it says that chamber was over was some 50,000 years old.
That's what it's believed to be.
Yeah. That it's and also that now this Tibetan monk,
Lama.
I guess.
Monk or Lama, yeah.
Okay. Says that there's above events in motion in order to change major imbalances in the earth. And the Tibetan Lama claims to have put the above events in motion in order to change major imbalances in the earth. So what did they mean by that? I mean,
okay.
What did he put in motion, actually?
Well, I will explain. And
yeah.
And but let me just finish that last thing I was saying. This
sure.
This puts one in the position, this book, and the way he talks about karma and you know, the future and one's personal condition, it focuses on personal responsibility. This is what I was going to say. Focuses on the personal responsibility of the individual. And he gives a very cogent message about that and is having us all look at a paradigm of, well, maybe the world isn't quite the way we thought it was. It's certainly not the way I thought it was, and it stretched my mind. Now, but to get to your question is the imbalance. He explains how the earth is like an individual. It has its own aura. And the aura of the earth, the electromagnetic field, it is in trouble. The earth is in significant trouble, and it only takes, you know, looking at the madness surrounding nuclear power and whatnot, the madness around the whole energy stuff, which most of your fans are probably very familiar with, the madness of the financial world, the deception by governments and this sort of thing. So it's in a very sick, I mean, you know, the pollution that occurs, the deforestation. Yes, it's in a very critical state. Now, it's not the first time it's been in a critical state, but basically where this story goes, and I you know, to, rather than to answer you in of a short sentence, this Radu is getting initiated all night waiting for the Lama to appear. It just sort of happenstance by this alchemist. He's being told all these things about long life and whatnot. It's a congenial discussion. At the end of the evening, the Lama appears, and the Lama appears with a very strange creature with him called a Yidam. And a Yidam is very much a part of this imbalance you were referring to. The Yidam is about 7 feet high, and he's corporeal, meaning he's material, but he's not material like you or I. He can kind of fade out and fade in, and he makes himself appear. He's a fierce creature. And the Lama explains that he's created at a high level of teachings in a lamasery, where somebody reaches a level where they need to expand beyond their human body in terms of interfacing with the physical universe. But if their human body is going to interface with these energies, the human body can't stand up to it. So they create an extension of themselves, which is what a Yidam is, through a San Mandela ritual. You've seen these pretty
Peter,
colors.
If I may for a minute, Leo, we've been talking about some of Carlos Castaneda's work and so forth. And basically we're talking about some of the Toltec traditions or understanding of spiritualism. Peter, go ahead. I just wanted to break in with that, to, I think, to familiarize.
It would fit in, with those traditions. And I'm circuitously going about to address Leo's question, because it's a very circuitous answer. But basically, the Yidam is there to act as a facilitator in regions of the ethers, if you will, that a human being, a spiritual being in a human body, is not going to be able to negotiate with his human body. Now, the obvious conclusion would be that this Yidam is a part of the Lama's creation, but it was not. It's not something the Lama created out of his own mind. It's something somebody else created. And this Yidam character is somebody he's worked with. And what it all comes down to is that the Yidam's being introduced to Radu to familiarize him with him, because they're going to take a journey in about 4 days' time, and they're going to go to Transylvania, and they're going to go a part of southern Transylvania into these mountain range where they go, and they do go there, and a translation is effected. And a translation is basically where they go from one realm to another. It's kind of, you know, having the hollow deck superimposed upon your current environment, where all of a sudden you see the sky change to another sky, the corners change to other corners, and you go from one. It's called a translation. And this is affected by the Yidam, and it's in a very
specific... Now, the Yidam, is that like the Merkaba? No.
Nothing
to do with that. Okay.
No.
It sounds like you're transcending different dimensions here.
You are. But the Yidam is a extension of yourself, of your mind. It's a mental projection. And the mental projection takes material form. And it operates, it's an extension of yourself.
But it's limited, too.
What does it do?
It's limited.
If it's limited, it's you know, got some pretty impressive powers that a human being wouldn't have, because it's working on the mental plane. There's a causal plane at the highest, a mental plane, and
is this part of shape shifting, or does it have anything to do with that, or no?
It's not really shape shifting. It's different. It's different than shape shifting, and it's its own separate tradition. It's not. Don't try and mix it with others, because although it might complement others, it's really different.
Okay.
And if you look up Yidam on Wikipedia, you'll see different definitions, and there's different traditions, some of which partially fit in with this. But this is by talking to somebody who's really doing it, not somebody who's an academic. So,
you know, you're right. Just go right ahead. You know, I'm sorry to break in before, but, you know, it's an understanding that I'm learning. Go ahead.
All right, so anyway, the Yidam affects this translation to Tibet. And this is where I was speaking on another show the other night that George was listening to, and we got taken off. We cut off when we got to the cave in Tibet, because all four of these characters, the Eleanor, Radu, the Yidam, and the Lama, they go to this cave in Tibet, and it's a part of the world where you couldn't scale this wall. It's too high, it's too slick. So this is an area where the Lama explains that there will be very harsh energies that will, if you get in this area, that are there to stop you, because it belongs to a resident elemental or a resident spirit that you have to appease with, you know, incense sacrifice or whatever. And the Yidam is and will stop you if it does not like you or does not want you. The Yidam is there to protect them on the journey, because he can wield his shield, so to speak. He can work the elements to keep them safe. And he's a
Jedi
very
Knight,
important...
right?
Pardon? Pardon?
A Jedi Knight, but no, I'm only kidding.
You know, maybe he'd have something like an etheric light sword, so to speak, because he's very powerful. And so anyway, he keeps the temperature warm, and he keeps them safe. They do not have any incidents when they get there. And they go into the cave, and basically Radu is sent to go in alone after a certain area where he meets another character who's a blue female goddess or Dakini, and she's very tall. I think she's very tall, and she's very beautiful, and she's very blue, and she's described in rather graphic detail by him, and she basically gives him another initiation. Now, you got to remember, this is 12 days of initiation that Radu goes through, and it's a very remarkable experience for somebody to be taken by any of these beings, an alchemist, a lama, and a yidam, and to interface with all of them and to be taken beyond your normal reference frame. This normally does not happen to individuals. People have amazing near-death experiences sometimes, but this is not a near-death experience. So anyway, he's taken to this, and the goddess has something in store for him. She talks to him. They have a conversation. There's some sort of, you know, translation factor going on. I can't really explain it. He touches on it in the book. But he's being initiated in another dimension. It's also explained that this area of Tibet they're in is a gateway to another world, something like you saw the movie in Shangri-La or The Lost Horizon.
Right.
And there's another world beyond. This is the gateway to another world, but he's not going to be going to this other world. Perhaps this is the realm of the inner earth that's alluded to earlier with Caesar going to become an ambassador. But this blue creature, basically what her agenda is to put a manuscript into Radu's hands. And it is a scroll of ancient times, not super ancient. I think it's might even be 1400. You know, it might be 780. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's in this after Christ era. And this is a written in an old Tibetan script, and she puts it in his hands so that he can go back and have it translated in. Shared to the world, and it includes five meditation techniques, and it's a tantric manuscript because she was a tantrika or a dakini. Now, her history is interesting, and I can't elaborate on it too much because I don't.
Is this the same? Is this the same blue goddess that you had on the Montauk of the Living?
No, it's a different blue goddess. But it corroborates so much of what I've written about the blue people, and
right.
And so she is. In other words, I've been writing around about these blue people for over 10 years, and all of a sudden it comes manifest through an author in Transylvania. It didn't come through me. I didn't have the experience. It came through an author in Romania, and he's taken to Transylvania, and has this experience in Tibet. I've also written about Tibet. So this is kind of like the universe talking back to me in one respect from my own personal perspective. But this manuscript is brought back, and they bring it back, and it's the Lama's job, because he understands Tibetan, to translate it. He's got to translate it, and he's got to consult some text. And this translation of this book becomes Book 4, which is the sacred part, secret parchment. And I have not read it because I haven't read Book 3 or Book 4. So this
is
something that
is Book 3, by the way?
Book 3 is called Mystery of Egypt, the Prime Tunnel, where they go in one of the tunnels to Egypt and encounter whatever there is to be encountered. And part of this is Radu, after this experience he has with the Tibetan Lama, he's then recruited in Book 3 into Department Zero. He begins working for the secret apparatus of Romanian intelligence under Caesar. And in Book 4 goes into some of that too. And so I really don't know what it's about. I've got a brief summary in it in the book you've read, Sunrise. And I write a little to summarize it at the end of this book. But it's a great mystery. But the one thing is, and I saw
in
this book.
Stick with two right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like I've read this over 5 times just to proof it alone. And it's like every time I read it, I go, oh, God, he said this, he said this. And to absorb it into your mind, it basically what it gave me, who was, I say, I'm already working at a higher clip than most human beings before I got involved in the Qigong. And now I'm learning to extend my life, my breathing. And now I'm saying, wow, this makes me ups the ante anymore. Maybe I'm not going to stay around for, 150 years in good shape. It might have to be extended to 300-400. And I should, what he says here, he says, once people reach several hundred years old, like 300-400, and there's not a lot of people that even do this tradition, they generally, the whole purpose is to ascend and not need a human body anymore. You kind of grow out of the need for it on a spiritual, psychological level. And it's about evolving, like, from a caterpillar to a butterfly, only we're talking about in a human form, from a human form to a spiritual form. It's an ascension process, a word that is very often misused you're doing this great work, you're learning, and if you have a perspective of living hundreds and hundreds of years, your whole perspective changes. And in this particular case, the security issue becomes for Eleanor, because at the end of the book, he says, or maybe it's the beginning of the book 3, which we've summarized, even though I haven't read it, they've summarized it for me, and Eleanor has to leave Romania for security issues, because he says he's been left a great fortune in wealth. He's got homes across the world, alchemy labs. But the problem is, he says, if you look like you're 30 and you stay like you're 30 and you stay in one place too long, people are going to wonder about you and question you, and you become a target. So you have to move. And you can't, keep friends for a long, long time. Interesting perspective.
Yeah. And is it this Qigong that the study of that is doing that to him?
No. In fact, I'm studying Qigong. He doesn't mention Qigong. But I notice when Radu is describing him, he doesn't mention his breathing. I can evaluate anybody by their breathing now. And is he taking a full breath? I don't know how he breathes. But my Qigong teacher told me, he says, there's ways to vibrate that can keep you young. It's about energy. And he's kept young through a geometric device that he is learns to build. And it's a whole school of learning how to build it, which is tailored to a specific individual. And
I don't know if it was one of your books or it may have been. But there was that I saw this picture of this Buddhist monk, who supposedly is over 300 years old, and he looks like he's 20. All right, and this is true. This is a true story. Was that from one of your books? I can't remember.
No,
it was.
But there. According, and I can't prove this to you, but I mean, from what I've been told through my Qigong teacher and whatnot, there are Taoists in the Orient who get away from human beings because the human beings pollute them, sully them. They have to get away. And they'll sit out there in the mountains working energy as he would say, keeping this planet from blowing up, keeping it alive, because they're channeling pure life energy, and those are real masters. And if there are people like that, it doesn't take a PhD or a genius to figure out what's going to happen to them if they come down into this world. The first thing, and meet the McDonald's empire. Every attempt will be done to degrade them and to bring them down to the level of where humanity is at. And they don't, now whether those beings are there or not is an open question. It's for you, it's for you to discover. It's for me to discover.
Well, it was a brilliant, brilliant work that Maria Algieri turned me on to. It was the Agni Yogi. I did probably 20 or 30 programs on that work. There was 13 books, I believe. And in those books, they talk specifically about this, the power of the initiate, and developing this understanding, not only of the universe, of time and space, universe, but they also talk about the hierarchy. There's one specific book about the hierarchy, and it talks about the different levels of masters, ascended masters, who are actually channeling just like you said, Dalis who are projecting this information, and to the Earth, all right, and to the third dimension, and from that it's being picked up by many, many different people, but these inspirations and these higher from these six and higher dimensions are actually guiding force to the to many on this planet.
Let me clarify though. They're not channeling information; they're channeling energy, and much of the information that has been channeled and discussed by Preston Nichols and I is something called Project Bluebeam, where there's a lot of information being channeled by people who are sensitive that is just misleading people. I'm not speaking of the yogis you were speaking of, because I don't know them, but I'm seeing a lot of information from higher dimensions that's just like distraction, sort of like our media in our regular world.
I'm very curious though, because I know what you're saying, and I know I remember Preston mentioning that as well. But what disturbs me, and I can't understand, is why so many powers or so many entities, if you will, powers that be, are trying to limit our knowledge, are trying to suppress that knowledge, or suppress this information, for human beings. Why is that?
Well, it's the paradigm. It's the way things are. It's kind of like if you were born in a prison, and your parents were both prisoners in a jail, and they were allowed to interact, and you were allowed to interact with them, you'd say, "Why is it this way, Daddy?" And he'd tell you some long story, which he may or may not know to be true, and it's just the way it is. And of course, why is it this way? It's just the way it is. Most people do not question the circumstances or the foundations in which they grow up. They generally go by what they're told. And of course, this book, I've always been a questioner of all of that. I never accept anything. And this book caused me to rethink my entire views of the platform that we live in. The other thing I've noticed about the spiritual path is that people I've known that have been very deeply involved with so-called great spiritual teachers, who were great to the degree that they could demonstrate incredible phenomena. They were worthy of admiration to the degree that they could demonstrate phenomena. And some of these people end up getting vampirized by these beings because although they may have power, it becomes a, you know, alpha contest. Who's the alpha spirit? The alpha spirit will consume, you know, the smaller spirits. And this is an unfortunate thing for people seeking out on the spiritual path. You know, you can get fairly competent and
you
strong.
Know, this reminds me of the Toltec path, what happened to the Mayans, the early Mayans, who were into sorcery, that were actually taken over by this higher power. I'm sorry, it was just an aside there. I was reminded of that. That was how the leaders and the priests of the Mayans were decimated. Basically, they were destroyed because of by their involvement in the black arts and by their involvement with higher spirits than themselves, but not really understanding the power there that they had or the power that those spirits had.
Exactly. It becomes, I mean, you realize it's survival of the fittest in the spiritual realm, not just in the physical realm. And
yeah, that's frightening, isn't it? It really is. And you think that it's the same way.
It's frightening. You know, there is such a thing in you know, more conventional spiritualism as prayer. There's other techniques in Taoist Qigong. It's about balancing and grounding. So as much as, it can be frightening, it's from the lack of following the more positive aspects of a spiritual tradition and grounding yourself in them. It's kind of like, can you imagine how frightening it would be for an average person, particularly an older person, to be out on an NFL football field as opposed to the players themselves? They're not scared to be out there, but it's dangerous, but they're not scared. But if you put a person out there who doesn't have equipment on and isn't in shape and is somewhat frail, it's frightening. And if one fortifies themselves, you know, with I guess the strength of the spirit, these things are negotiable. Something, but one has to be aware of the landscape that they're dealing with and moving into. And unfortunately, too many people that read, they excite their mind, they read stuff that's interesting, and they don't ground to the real world, and they get all excited, just like Republicans and Democrats get all excited about their candidate rather than looking at the real picture of what's going on.
Peter, if I could break in for a minute and ask you a question. And it's one thing that hasn't been talked about too much, and this has to do with time. Like, it's funny now how, you know, this thing is being brought out at this time. David Anderson is one example, I think, of the consciousness is being laid out into the open. Now, what I was saying before is a synchronicity. You know, everything is synchronized. I do believe that. But, you know, it's the synchronicity that we're experiencing as a culture. Now, Leo and I have been looking at the Mayan calendar for the last 4 years. And there's a synchronicity there, but there's an ending time, or there's a focused time, I should say. And Terence McKenna's work with novelty winding down, which is based with the Qigong, that there is a winding down and ending of a period. Now, my question is, this information that's being released and, you know, in this series of books, what do you think it's telling us as sentinel beings of the experiences that we experience in life, but also the connections we have to the outside world? And, you know, if you can answer some of that, I'd like to get more of an understanding, because this is what I'm looking at. That this time factor is all basically one. But
it was said to me when I first got into this work and started exposing some of these things, which I think is quite accurate. The veil is becoming thinner.
Yes.
When you know my parents didn't question these things, their parents questioned them even less. You know, you went to the priest, you got sexually abused, and you didn't talk about it. You know,
right?
And
right.
You know, because the priest wouldn't do such a thing. I mean, you know, that happened in my family, my father's family. You know, you didn't talk about it. You know, don't tell mom. You know, or mom doesn't believe you. You know, so we live in a society and a culture where, for all of its shortcomings, which are many, particularly in the spiritual fields, it still is the paradigm. The picture has become much more clear as to, you know, we're allowed to. Well, like in Martin Luther, he said you can go direct to God and direct to the Scripture. You know, he didn't really question the Scripture, but he said you could go direct to it, which the clergy and the Catholics wouldn't allow them to go direct to it. You had to go through the priest. So Martin Luther got up to the point of saying, well, you can go direct to the Scripture yourself, and they translated it with the Gutenberg Bible.
They discourage you going to the Scripture.
You couldn't go yourself because you had to be a clergy to go. And the Catholics protected that. And Martin Luther, when the Gutenberg press came out and they printed the Bible, now he said the common man can go and get Scripture for himself. Why he didn't question the Scripture is beyond me. But, you know, he didn't even hold it to question. It was not to be held to question. So we've questioned many things, and we've looked beyond the veil, and even people, I say, who may not be grounded, may not be the most suited to do anything, they still can see, how all of us can see, that things are not quite the way we were told when we were children, and they're probably not the way we thought they were when we grew up to be adults. And, you know, it causes you to change, causes you to think, causes you to be more powerful. And as George was talking about the end of the calendars, well, there's also, you know, this is the end of the great Kali Yuga by another tradition. In other words, time is in the galaxy is changing so that more light, we're going to become more into the light of the galactic center, which means we're going from the dark to the light, which means more information, more enlightenment, more happiness. This is the great cosmic trigger, so to speak, that's coming undone. So these literature that's being unveiled, and other literature as well that has nothing to do with me, is simultaneously bringing about a awareness. Just like when we had in the 60s or the 1970, I think it was, the first Whole Earth Day, all of a sudden a whole bunch of people were aware of the Earth in a way they hadn't been. And now maybe we're all becoming aware of the galaxy in a way we haven't been. But it's synchronicity, it's timing, we're watching, you know, just like when everybody saw the moon landing, you know, when we all, you know, assuming it actually was somebody landing on the moon, because I know it's a controversial topic now, but when we all saw that, we felt, wow, everything had changed. Everything
My
had
point
changed.
Doesn't matter. Go ahead.
No, but I think the feeling is it had all changed. And you know what? Whether the moon landing happened as they told us or not, it did tell us that man could go to the moon, which man can go to the moon. So that was the point, and it's all of a sudden humanity is now on a different level, and that's for darn sure. So the feeling you got if you were watching Walter Cronkite was a valid feeling, regardless of what the circumstances were. So, you know, it's like, and now we're moving into a place where we can now look at time differently. And David Anderson has said we may find out that, you know, time is just, history has just been one experiment. And if that's the case, you know, it might be a relief. You know, it might be a relief. It's just like waking up from a dream that you weren't quite sure about, or you really wished it hadn't happened quite that way.
And, Peter, you know what scares me with your involvement with psychotronics and my involvement, James Bearden's work with scalar wave energies. You know, it goes beyond time, where it's not restricted by time. So, you know, it's we've already conquered that time issue. You know, on an energy level, but you know, on an emotional or a physical level, you know, that's secondary. But I'm sure Rod Dew and his workings may bring some light on that.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you say about Radu, because as I correspond with Radu, and there was a whole question of whether he knew David Anderson or whether David Anderson knew him, and David thought he knew of Radu or had met him, but David didn't seem to be telling me. He seemed to be withholding something. Well, Radu says point blank, I don't know David. And David seemed funny about it. And as I began to read this book over and over, I began to say, well, you know, David knows world leaders, and he would, and Rinpoche Sunday says, he knows, he's the name of the Lama, he knows world leaders too. He knows world leaders in China. He says he knows world leaders over the world. And maybe that David's interaction of knowledge of Radu came through the Lama. I've written to Radu about that, and he said, although he wouldn't disinclude the possibility, he doesn't think so, because he didn't think that's the way he worked, but he wouldn't deny that it happened. So Radu is, I mean, he's obviously on a high level, but he's not on the level of the Lama or maybe David's level. He's certainly not on David's level in terms of interfacing with world leaders. So that's, you know, that's an interesting question. And, of course, David... I mean, Stuart Swerdlow, when I used to visit with him years ago and I was helping him with his book, he used to say that all these world leaders have psychics around them and they're having, like, psychic battles. Well, it's probably true. Because he knows these similar people. Well, David Anderson said that, you know, in his working with world leaders and all this and the people he works with, is that they're all concerned about time, the changing of time, the manipulation. Time is a weapon. So, you know, it's a whole paradigm that the average politician and the average citizen doesn't think of. And as we move, but we're even more able to think this way. We're, you know, we couldn't think. And even I was watching the president roast Donald Trump, and it was very funny. He said, you know, now that I've, you know, shown my birth certificate, you can get busy with the, you know, whether people landed on the moon or not. And the whole Washington press corps is laughing. They're laughing at conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
But you know, I take umbrage to that, and I'll tell you why. Because they're showing that birth certificate that he did produce was a forgery. All right. And now this bogus lie of Obama being thrown off the deck of an aircraft carrier and burial at sea. I mean, this whole thing is just one. Obama has got to be the biggest, lousiest liar. Okay, Bush was a good liar. He was a pathological liar. All right, but he was a good liar. Whereas this guy is just a lousy liar.
Well,
and he's an incompetent. Okay.
Well, I think it's a mistake to even point the finger at Obama, because you have a institutionalized media and infrastructure which is good at lying. Because if you look at this, and I don't know that we should digress onto this topic, but if you wanted to control a president, it would be very good to have a president that you had something on. And if he was not born here and you could give him a credential to be born here. And now the funniest thing is they've shown that this long-form birth certificate was photoshopped.
This is hysterically funny
from a perspective of how do you explain it. Because and as soon as they're being challenged to explain it, they ignore it, and Obama turns up killed instantaneously. And it takes all that attention off, and Trump cannot go after Obama now because he would look unpatriotic if he did.
That's
he can't
true.
Bring up the birth certificate issue.
Well, I have something to say, I think. You know, this illusion And that's what I see it as. It's one big illusion. You could see right through it. It's like the wizard beyond the curtain, you know. Don't worry about that man behind the curtain. Responsible people can see through it, and that illusion is faded. So, you know, it's that illusionary consciousness that we're
now the 911 illusion, all right, I saw it 10 years ago, and I've been talking about it ever since. And you know what a fraud it was, and now that the Bin Laden is finally put to rest for the 10th time, the veil is totally lifted because you can see what a lie the entire thing is. But I getting back to what you said about being in a prison, I guess that's what we are. We're in that matrix. Or in the prison of the third dimension, but by understanding this and identifying these people that lived 25,000 years ago or still are living, we don't know. How does that break us out of the of this prison?
Doesn't. And let me explain. I want to give this analogy. I think it's very apropos to people that study too much conspiracy, because I get too many people think they're a news service right now. Friends of mine or colleagues or just people that email me, and everybody thinks they're a news service, and it's irritating because they're arguably less qualified to be a news service than the news services we don't trust. But in any case, what all of this chasing the bad guys in conspiracy, the Bohemian Grove people, while some of it's arguably interesting, it's much like the wizard, as George was alluding to in The Wizard of Oz, sending Dorothy to get the witch's broom. That's right. A wild goose chase. He sends her off to get the witch's broom. Right. She brings it back, and, they find that he's a phony. And we learn that all the powers are in her ruby red slippers. The power is inside of you. And that's another thing of Taoist Qigong, at least the way I learn it. It's not necessarily taught that way in China. It's to empower you, not to make you a sheeple. And in the movie The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy has to empower herself before she can get back home, which is what you're alluding to as prison. Oz is a beautiful place, but it's a prison to her because it's not her home.
That's right, No, I understand. I understand your analogy.
You want to give out the information on your website and so forth where people who are interested in this material, they can contact you?
Well, my website is skybooksusa.com. The new book is not on there. You can get the e-book version for Kindle at Amazon, Transylvania Moonrise. But if you want the book right now until we get our new website up, it's just email us at skybooks@yahoo.com, and we'll send you a PayPal invoice for the hard copy book. It's on discount for $19 right now instead of the normal
$22. Well, I highly recommend the book. I think the series is excellent, and being an empath, I'm really intrigued because I think it has a lot to say of our times, and that's all I could say, Peter.
Well, I wanted to say that I wanted to say a couple things. I was fascinated by your books, Pete, constantly, all of them that I've read, and in fact, I got the Montauk Book of the Living here in my hands. I also got the Transylvania Sunrise, but I'm always impressed with what you come up with, and I'm really looking forward to reading this new book. But I just to touch base again on this these tunnels, this thing going back to the Transylvanian moonrise. Where in your book, where does it lead us? Where does that book lead us in this series? Well, in this understanding this new knowledge.
Well, the tunnels are explored in book three, which, as I say, I haven't read.
The book two that's just come out. Let's just concentrate on that for a minute. Where does that lead us?
Well, that book is, as I was saying, it leads us to a personal paradigm of possibly extending one's life. It's an alchemical tradition. When I'm reading this book, and I'm the first one to read it in English, and it's the translation is not that great. I have to do a lot of changing, so I'm like really gripping the information. I say, well, you know, it feels like I'm getting personally let in on some great big secret, some great big secret, and it's like a personal initiation for me. And it's like, you know, wherever I had to pay for the translation, you know, I guess it would be $800 of our money or something. It's like, that's not the type of price you'd pay for one book. Well, I'm saying, like, wow, it would be worth paying $800 to read that book. You know, if you're getting a secret initiation. Well, okay, this book is going to go out to thousands of people, and they're going to read it. Many will read it as entertainment. Oh, good idea. Will they be able to get initiated into this tradition? They'll know about it. It makes initiation more available. It puts it into the consciousness. And even the Lama says, well, this tradition is not my tradition. It's not his tradition. He knows about it. He's familiar with it, but he has a different tradition. You know, and he doesn't really elaborate on what that is, but it's got to be a very powerful one, as does the Blue Goddess, who's at a level that is obviously higher than the Lama. And the Lama is very high level because he talks about time travel offhandedly. He mentions it. He doesn't say a lot about it, but when they're talking about the translation, he says, oh, yeah, you don't have to worry about, you know, things being discombobulated when you come back. And then he makes some offhanded comment about time travel as if he knows it and has experienced it. So we're dealing with a level of evolution that is beyond what you might expect in a human form. And
but do you believe that, with this time travel, do you believe that people are going back into time and, you know, correcting or going into the future and preparing? Or what's the, or are they neutral? Do they travel but can't?
If I were to answer that with the inspiration of the Lama and how he, and guessing how he might answer it, he would say the way we see things in this dimension is distorted. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, somebody that is living in the bottom of a pool with scuba gear saying, can you actually get out of the pool and go out and go to a shopping center? And they don't even know what a shopping center is. Right. Where they can walk all around the pool. You know, somebody can get up at the pool, walk all around and look at it, put cameras into it. There could be a whole audience looking into the pool, but all these guys can see is what's in the pool with their scuba gear, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
They can't look out and see above, beyond the water. That's kind of how we are in this dimension. So it's kind of like, you know, when we start asking questions about, you know, about the, you know, time, it's like, you know, we're looking through that water, and maybe we don't even have the scuba mask, so we can't even see that clearly.
Well, Peter, I want you to know that I'm a sentinel being having a human experience, my friend, not a human having a spiritual experience.
But you mentioned this Yidam again.
Right.
Or you mentioned the Yidam. Isn't that, if this is something that you're projecting...
I'm going to lose charge in a second here. I'm going to try and go to another phone.
Okay.
I better go fast. I'll call back if it hangs up.
Okay.
All right, I got it. I saved the phone. Okay, I'm here.
Oh, great. Okay, the manifestation of thought projection, that's what the Yidam is, correct?
Yes, it's a mental projection.
Right. So it can we, in essence, project the different dimension? Can we project, is that what that is? Is it our projection outward of our own idea of the fourth or fifth or whatever dimension?
Well,
is it our perception manifested, or is it existing and we're walking into it? Well, how does it work?
Well, according to various teachings, and you can look it up, it's you know, there's an astral plane, There's a mental plane, and there's a causal plane. And each, as you get to the higher plane, it becomes more abstract. And the mental plane is where, you know, things are decided and whatnot. And there's all these, I guess, hierarchies, celestial hierarchies that go along with these things. And this is just a high level of where somebody has, you know, worked their way through the astral soup, which has got a lot of pitfalls in it, and they've worked their way up to, into the mental plane and can actually be causing forces that not only do you think, but that other people think. That's why you could see this thing, because he's projecting. It's a mental projection, but he projects into physical realm. So not only can you see it, but other people can see it.
Right, right.
That's a collective consciousness that helps hold it together.
But
yeah.
But in that same term, is it possible to project what the or to see fourth dimensional existence, to see it, to break through?
Well, certainly it would be possible, and that's in the eye of the beholder. You know, it's like, yes, it would be the observer, and it would be possible. And
well, it's like thought equals manifestation, right? I mean, that's what we're dealing with here. You mean what you're thinking is what you're thinking, what you're projecting in your thoughts is actually manifesting into reality.
That's the idea.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm just trying to grasp this. Because George and I have discussed this many times, this concepts. But to see it to understand it from a 25,000-year-old society that created these tunnels and these holograms.
I'm sure they go beyond that, Leo, but the older civilizations of antiquity.
Yeah, but this is proof. This is real proof, though you haven't seen it yourself, this is the author did. This is real proof of their existence.
Well, he doesn't offer it as proof, but it's data. It's really data and it's testimony.
Right.
And of course, it's explained in the book that some of the characters from the Ramayana, which is one of the great epics along with the Bhagavad Gita of the Indian culture, is it took place in Transylvania, the Ramayana, and there were atomic wars, and that the Ramayana is a derivative version. It's in other words, he says it's kind of turned into an allegorical version of what happened. Of the main character Rama and his wife Sita, who lived in Transylvania in this spot where they translated from. So it's like in the history, and there was an atomic wars. And another author has pointed out to me that this culture that we're living in is suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome from atomic wars that occurred, 50, 40, 20,000 years ago, and that we're still haven't recovered from those, and that's why some of the fascination with nuclear power still goes on to this day. It's kind of a post-traumatic stress reaction.
That's fascinating to think. So believing that we're all reincarnated time and time and time again from that period.
I think in the first interview, you talked about there was a time, I think it was about 600 A.D., where time stopped. And, you didn't elaborate on it, but, it caught my attention. I would be interested if the ancients knew or had any partake in changing or manipulating our consciousness on that level.
Well, what they said is that Radu said that the history of the world stops. It kicks off at around 500 A.D., 400 or 500 A.D. It doesn't go up to 600 A.D., and it just stops, and they don't know why it stopped. But you got to remember, when that book was written, they'd only explored
explored the chamber for 3 weeks. It's been explored for like a decade now, so or almost a decade, the better part of a decade. So 8 years.
Information is still coming out on it.
Yeah, so I mean, but it's not been released, at least in this point. And one of the things, so it was like they thought maybe it needed a software update. Well, maybe time was manipulated. But it said that when Caesar came back from the Great Expedition, which is part of what Book 3 is about, he gave a debrief, and I think at last they interviewed him for 4 days or something like that. And when they were all done, they just didn't know how to respond to the data that he gave them. The, you know, the brass, the military or the top brass in America and Romania. They, in other words, they're like dumbfounded. They're astounded, and they're not. They have ontological shock, and they're not capable of really dealing with the information, filtering it, let alone processing it and analyzing it and making sane decisions about it. And of course, we see this same, reaction. You know, they don't know how to handle it. Now, what he also tells us is that Caesar doesn't tell him everything, you know. He keeps some of the stuff to himself. He doesn't mention certain things that would, and they can't even handle what he tells them. It's like if gray aliens landed at Roswell, if that's what happened, the government, the military, they don't know how to process the information. So they end up being vulnerable and overtaken by some other factor.
Well, Peter, I have to say, my friend, you did a hell of a job with the Montauk series, and in your new adventure with Radu, you have a hell of a venture in front of you, and I find it fascinating. I really do, and wish you the best, Peter. And I think this information is meant to be released now, and I think with your connections, in all your works, and, you know, I know a bit about your background, but I think it's all coming together, and this is just part of that information that is part of you. And even though it may have been written by another person by your translation, you are part of that. And I wish you the best of luck, my friend.
Well, I want to thank you for your contributions in the earlier years, because you were there when nobody else was around, and certainly before I was around, and the enclave of Preston and Duncan. And so, thank you for your contribution as well.
And I wanted to say, I wanted to thank you, Pete, for being on tonight. Of course, George, thank you. But I hope to be able to have you back on when I get a copy of this book and see it and read it. Because if it's anything like the other one, I was completely floored by it. And I'm really looking forward to seeing this one.
I liked it much more than the first one, personally.
Really?
And I liked the first one.
Yeah. And so for anybody listening right now, it's you can go to Amazon.com, and I believe it's available in ebook right now, and it'll soon be available in it shows it's not available to Amazon yet in printed copy. So but it's called the Transylvanian Moonrise, as by Radu Sinemar and Peter Moon.
At Sky Books.
At skybooks.com. And
skybooksusa.com.
SkyBooksUSA.com. I'm sorry.
There we go.
I'll correct that. But thank you, Pete, for being on. And thank you, George.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And good night.
Take care.
Thank you, Peter. Leo, have a good night. Thank you.
George, you have a good night, too.
Okay.
And I want to thank everybody who joined us tonight and, listening. And you can get this on the archives again in about, if you missed the first part, in about 10 minutes or so. But in the meantime, I want to thank you and wish you a pleasant evening.